Tassar, or with James Holden, or with her father, or Connor, or Muriel, or God. Even when she drifted just a little bit away from herself, she woke up minutes later with her back teeth aching from being clenched together. "Seriously? You're one of the angriest people I know, Tiny," Timothy said in her memory. Now it felt true. After midnight, she gave up. Muskrat thumped her tail against the floor twice. "What are you so fucking happy about?" Teresa snapped. Muskrat stopped wagging, and her gray canine eyebrows rose in an expression of concern. Teresa turned on the state news feed and watched one of the professional voices of Laconia make reassuring mouth noises. "The repair of the gate repeaters is already underway, and the communications network should be restored in a matter of weeks. Normal trade between worlds will resume very soon after that. Until then, the High Council is determining which supply ships are critical to the Empire and approving transits on a case-by-case basis. The tragedy in the ring space, which claimed the lives of so many loyal to the Laconian Dream, has shown no signs of recurring, according to the Science Directorate. Lies, half-truths, fictions, and bullshit." Rage and grief fought in her heart, and behind them, looming larger than the sky, a sense of overwhelming betrayal that she couldn't put a name to. Muskrat chuffed once in concern. Teresa bared her teeth in a grin. "I'm not allowed to tell the truth. I'm not allowed to feel anything. I'm not allowed to leave the compound," she said. "I can't do anything. You know why? Because I'm so important." Teresa got up, stalked to her window, and opened it. Muskrat looked away nervously. "Well?" Teresa said. "Are you coming or not?" She had never been to the field outside the compound at night. In the darkness, it seemed larger. Swarms of tiny insectile animals crawling along the ground glowed in patterns of moving stripes as she walked past, like her footsteps were making dry ripples on the ground. A cold breeze hissed through the bare trees. In the distance, something called out, its voice like a flute. Two others answered farther away. A smell like pepper and vanilla hung in the breeze. Illich had told her once that the chemistry of Laconia was so different from the one humans had evolved with that people struggled to make sense of it, inventing smells that weren't really there out of confusion. She had grown up here, though, and it seemed perfectly normal to her. Muskrat trotted along at her side, glancing up every few steps as if to ask, "Are you sure about this?" Teresa knew the way to the mountain like it was the back of her hand. She didn't worry at all about straying from the trail. In her imagination, Illich sputtered and scolded. He told her that the rules existed for good reasons, for her safety, that she couldn't just go and do whatever she wanted whenever she wanted. He'd know she was gone, that she'd ignored his rules. That was part of what made it worth doing. What could he do? Lock her in her room? When her father came back to himself, Illich would have to answer for everything he'd done in the meantime. Her father had known she went off the compound. If he hadn't stopped her, Illich wouldn't dare. He'd only make rules he couldn't enforce. A law without consequences wasn't a law. It wasn't anything. The first sign she was close was a shifting in the hedges and the bulbous false eyes of the repair drones peering apologetically out at her. They made their series of three falling clicks, an obvious query for which she didn't have time or an answer. Muskrat usually barked and tried to play with the drones, but tonight she only paid attention to Teresa. The drones followed them to the canyon. In the deeper darkness, it was hard to make out the path, but she moved forward all the same. Now that she'd come this far, second thoughts started to haunt her. What if she picked the wrong cave and startled some local animal in its sleep? What if Timothy wasn't there? High above, the orbital construction platforms rippled and glowed. If she looked out of the corner of her eye, she could even make out the Whirlwind, the third Magnetar-class ship. Only no. It was the second now. The flute thing called out again, closer this time. She wished she'd brought a light with her. She hadn't thought starlight would be so dark. She found a deeper shadow that she thought was the sandstone shelf. She ducked under, her hand stretched in front of her. It only took a few steps more before she saw the cavern's lights. The cavern was brighter than the night, and warmer, too. The repair drones that walked with her had followed her in, or other ones had been there to begin with. She couldn't tell them apart. Her heart was beating faster. She was sure that she'd turn the last corner and find Timothy gone, his camp vanished. "Timothy," she called, her voice trembling. "Are you here?" A slick metallic sound came from her right, and Timothy stepped out of the shadows, a gun in his hand. He shook his head.
"You gotta be more careful, Tiny," he said. "My eyes ain't what they used to be."
Timothy's expression and the casual way he held the gun were so comic, Teresa had to laugh. Once she started, it was hard to stop. The laughter seemed to have a life of its own, hilarity bursting out of her in a riot unstoppable and violent. Timothy's confused expression only made it funnier. She howled. She buckled over, holding her sides, and at some point she noticed that it wasn't laughter anymore, that she was crying. Timothy watched her like she was giving birth, and he wasn't a doctor. The visible understanding that there was probably something he should be doing to help, but he didn't know what it was. In the end, it was Muskrat who came and put her thick, heavy, fur-covered head against Teresa. The violence of her emotions left her spent, and she rubbed the dog's ears while the drones set up a little chorus of queries, aware that something was broken, but not how it could be fixed.
"Yeah, okay," Timothy said after a while. "Rough night, I get that. Come on back. You can... I don't know what you can do, but I want to sit down, so let's go back here."
Her limbs felt heavier as she walked, but her heart felt lighter, as if she'd come all this way for someone to watch her break down, and even though nothing had changed, something was better. The big man sat on his cot and rubbed his eyes with the knuckle of his first finger and his thumb. She sat across from him on a metal box, her hands in her lap.
"So," he said, "I don't really know how to do this part, but I think the way it goes is you tell me what's bothering you."
"So much has happened."
"Yeah?"
And she told him, all of it, from her father's tit-for-tat plan with the things hidden at the gates to the death of the typhoon, to the conspiracy to hide her father's illness and the bemused absence that he'd become. The more she talked, the easier it got. Timothy barely spoke, only asking a few questions here and there along the way. He just gave her his attention and asked for nothing in return. Eventually, she ran out of words. The sorrow in her chest was still there, still as painful and heavy and hard, but bearable somehow in a way it hadn't been before. Timothy ran his palm over his scalp. It was a dry sound, like dust hissing against a window. Back toward the mouth of the cave, Muskrat barked happily.
"Yeah, that all sucks," he said. "It's like that sometimes."
"It gets better, though, right?"
"Sometimes. Sometimes it's just one shit sandwich after another." He shrugged. "What are you gonna do? It's the only game in town."
"I just want..." Timothy held up his hand, gesturing her to silence. Muskrat barked again, the bark she used when she saw a friend, and there were voices behind it. Timothy scooped up his gun, his eyes fixed on the entrance. "It's okay," Teresa said. "They're probably just following me." Timothy nodded, but he didn't seem to hear her.
"Following you?"
"I have a tracker. They planted a tracker on me, can you believe that?" His eyes widened, just for a second.
"Ah, Tiny. Didn't see it coming down like this," he said.
She saw something in his face, and she couldn't tell if it was sorrow, or amusement, or both. Resignation, maybe.
"You should lie down on the floor there, flat as you can. Put your hands over your ears, okay?"
"Who's there?"
came from the entrance, sharp and hard. "No, it's all right. They're not going to be mad at you," Teresa said. And Colonel Illich stepped out of the gloom, a rifle in his hand. Three guards from the state building were behind him. Everyone went quiet. Teresa felt a sudden dread bloom in her heart, the realization that she'd misunderstood something badly, that she'd made a mistake she couldn't take back.
"You," Illich snapped, "put the gun down. Get away from the girl."
"Close your eyes, Tiny. You don't want to watch this."
"Stop," Teresa said. "He's my friend." The roar of Timothy's gun was louder than anything she'd ever heard. It was like being punched from all directions at once. The sound alone was a kind of violence. She dropped to her knees, her palms pressed against her ears. Gunfire ripped through the cave. Illich ran toward her, fear in his eyes, and pushed her down, shielding her with his body. Timothy was screaming like an animal, deep and full of rage. He pushed past her, past Illich, barreling toward the guards like he could brush them aside. The charge seemed to make the nearest man forget he had a gun in his hand. He tried to grab Timothy, but Timothy took the man's wrist like it was something that belonged to him, shifted it until it snapped. Illich pushed her down again, and she had to fight to see. Another gun fired. Someone shouted, not Timothy. Teresa twisted under Illich's knee, trying to find Timothy in the gloom. She got her head up enough to see him just as a wound bloomed on his leg. Redness splattered the cave behind him as he fell. Timothy lay in a fast-spreading pool of his own blood, twitching, trying to get up as if he didn't know his leg had been turned to splinters. He bared his teeth in pain and anger, swinging his gun around toward Illich. She screamed, "No!" She felt it ripping at her throat, but couldn't even hear it herself. Someone fired twice. The first round took the top of Timothy's head off. The second blasted a wide hole in his chest. Timothy collapsed, motionless. The silence after rang like a bell. "What did you do?" Teresa said. She didn't know who she was saying it to. Illich pulled her up. He bunched her shirt in his fist at the back of her neck like it was a handle, pushing her past Timothy's body.
"Fall back," Illich said. "Fall back to the truck. We have the girl."
Teresa shifted, trying to turn back to the cave. Timothy was hurt. She needed to help him. Illich yanked her along.
"Stevens is hit pretty bad," one of the guards said. "Carry him. We can't wait here. We don't know if the target was alone. We have to get the girl out."
"He's my friend," Teresa shouted, but Illich didn't hear her, or he didn't care. The night air was cold now. She could see her breath in the glare of the guard transport headlights. Illich shoved her into the back seat before pushing in beside her. They threw the wounded guard in the back. He groaned when the transport truck lurched backward. Illich leaned against her, murmuring something fast and low. Her ears weren't right, so it wasn't until she could shift enough to see his lips that she understood it was fuck, 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 fuck. There was blood in his neck, dark and thick.
"Sir," the driver said, "are you okay? You've been hit.
What?
Illich said, and then,
Teresa, are you okay? Tell me you're okay.
The transport truck hit a bump in the road, shaking a little, and the shock of it all fell away. She understood clearly what had just happened. She balled her fists, and she shrieked. The infirmary was quiet. She was shaking. Cortázar and Trejo and Kelly were all there, standing in the anteroom, talking to each other in low, urgent voices. Illich was in the autodock beside hers, a thick bandage on his shoulder and neck. Dawn would be coming soon. She didn't care as much as she'd expected to. The autodoc fed something cool into her bloodstream, another sedative maybe. It made her feel cloudy, but she wasn't going to sleep. She half suspected she'd never sleep again. When the door opened, Trejo stepped in. He wore gray flannel pajamas, a size too small for his belly. He didn't look like the secret ruler of humanity. He looked like a sleepy uncle. He pulled a chair up to her bed and sat down and sighed.
Teresa, he said sternly, I need you to tell me everything you know about the man in the cave. What he said to you, what you said to him, everything.
He was my friend, Teresa said.
He was not. We have body camera data from Illich and the recovery team. The facial recognition data matches the bloodstains. We know who he was. And once we have a secure perimeter and get a cleanup team back into that beshitted cave, we may have a better idea what he was doing here. But I need to hear everything from you. Now.
His name was Timothy. He was my best friend. Trejo's jaw went tight.
His name was Amos Burton. He was a terrorist and a murderer and a mechanic on James Holden's ship. And apparently he's been sipping tea with the daughter of the High Consul for months. Anything you told him, the underground may know. So begin at the beginning, go slow, be thorough, and tell me what you have fucking done to us.
Chapter 28. Naomi. The thing that surprised Naomi most was how quickly it happened. How little convincing people needed. She had assumed that Emma and Chava would agree because they knew her personally. They had a history together. And maybe their contacts would be amenable to connecting with her, since known safe members of the underground were vouching. After that, she had expected it to be difficult, sometimes impossible, to convince Saba's network to reveal itself to her. Everyone in the underground was in danger of death. Maybe worse. They would all be as wary as she would have been in their place. She'd overlooked the fact that she was Naomi Nagata, and that fear drove people to look for leaders. Emma had 5 contacts in the underground. 3 of them were on ships in other systems, but one was a technician in Oberon's planetary transfer station, and the other was an engineer on a transport union ship that was presently in system. Chava's connections were more local. A doctor at one of the major hospitals down the well, a taxation agent and forensic accountant on contract to Laconia, a manager of a fashionable brothel at the governmental center, the husband of a security specialist contracted with Laconia to maintain and protect the biometric identification systems. Some of those were single nodes in the network, but some were cell leaders with 4 or 5 other connections, some of whom knew a couple other people, and so on, until it felt like the underground had as many loyalists as the governor. It was an illusion, but it was a powerful one.
The thing is, the fuckers came in like the flood, yeah? The man across the table from her said.
He was a communications engineer for an independent design collective tasked with building a tight beam network, repeaters and relays, in the still unexplored vastness of Oberon system. He called himself Bone, but Naomi was fairly certain it was a nickname he'd given himself.
Overwhelming force, Laconia,
unstoppable, which, yeah, they are, but you can beat the shit out of a river and not change how it flows.
Wouldn't know, Naomi said. If he heard her, it didn't slow him down. Some men got loquacious when they were nervous.
They're one system, and not that populous. They've got no choice but to rely on us poor local bastards for help. And Laconia, he chuckled, Laconia has no local tradition of cheerful corruption. They don't expect it, and they don't know what to do about it when they find it. Besides, make the kind of examples of people that piss off all their families.
Give them time, Naomi said. They'll catch up, if we let them. Bone grinned. His left upper canine had been decorated to look like it was made from stone. Fashion never stopped. It was one of the many things Naomi was pleased that age allowed her not to care about anymore. She smiled back. The public park was another sign of Oberon's wealth and success. The designers of the lunar base had built in common areas and open space. The dome above them was still under the lunar surface, but light panels made it seem as open and airy as a resort on Titan. Children skipped in the thin gravity, hopping from bar to bar of a climbing structure that rose almost half the height of the Rossi. At a full G, a slip and fall would be fatal. Here, they might get bruised. A drip fountain beside them filled the air with white noise as the tiny drops drifted down from the ceiling and tapped an inclined slate, flowing slowly down to a fish-filled reservoir. It was beautiful. She didn't feel like she belonged there.
The repeaters, she said, bringing them back to the issue at hand.
Yeah, Bone said. We got your design out. Bottle network is on its way.
Nice thing about it?
Cheap. Any Union ship close to a ring gate can slip something out the lock.
Bone made a pushing gesture so graceful it was almost dance, and then snapped his fingers.
We'll be trading fresh gossip before you know.
Sol and Baragaon are the priorities.
Already got bottles through them. They know we're here and what we're doing. This can only spread.
And Laconia?
Bone shrugged.
Gotta figure they're putting up new repeaters, but we don't got one yet, and Oberon has money. So
they should have been a priority. Maybe they were. And other cells in the underground were breaking them. The bottle network was slow compared to the light-speed transmission they had all become accustomed to, but it was also hard to stop. Repeaters at the gates were static or nearly static targets, easy to identify and easy to destroy. The thing that had made them safe and stable all these years had been the eyes of Medina in the slow zone, the certainty that any action against them would be identified and traced back. With no eyes left in the slow zone, impossible things were suddenly practical.
Our local network, Naomi said. It's unbreakable?
Everything's breakable, Bone said. But we'll make them work for it. And it fails in sections, so we can shut it down before everyone's compromised.
It was the right answer. If he'd said they were safe, she'd have trusted him less.
Bien alles, she said and rose.
Bone followed her lead, holding his hand out to shake hers with a nervousness that looked like hero worship. She took his hand. Whatever the future brought, Bone could go through it remembering that he'd shaken hands with Naomi Nagata. She didn't like this sense of wearing a mask that everyone else had put on her, but it was the price she paid to do what needed doing.
I'll be in touch, she said, and they walked away, taking different paths out of the common space.
The corridors and passages of the base were wide and had low ceilings for someone her height. White tile glittered the same on the walls as the floor. 30 people could have walked abreast. She put her hands in her pockets, kept her eyes down, inviting everyone she passed to overlook her. Walking helped her think. Her problem, and her enemies, was the scale of it all. Millennia of human history had played out on the surface of a single planet. Mere centuries in the wide void between worlds,
And all of that had happened before her own birth. The universe she'd known had always had stations around Saturn and Jupiter, rockhoppers eking out livelihoods in the belt. Almost every gate led to another system that wide and complex, but without humanity, without history, without the infrastructure of everything humans took for granted and relied on. It had seemed smaller when there was a hub to the wheel. Now, anyone could transit anywhere, and there was no one to coordinate or record it. The more she thought about it, the more untenable the idea of rebuilding inside the slow zone seemed. Medina and the Typhoon and the fleet of Transport Union ships that had been caught there were proof that the nature of the space itself there wasn't benign. Putting a crude base there was risking the death of everyone involved. An automated one was a statement of faith in their computer security that history didn't justify. Holding and protecting over 1,300 gates from their starward faces was an entirely different prospect from holding one strong position in the center. It would take the largest fleet humanity had ever built just to watch the gates. And that didn't take policing the vastness of their solar systems into account. Duarte had come in with a strategy of permitting local governments autonomy so long as they followed his rules. It had seemed like a kind of magnanimity at the time. It looked more like necessity now. And deeper even than that, the eerie words, "Two gates lost." There had to have been a moment when they could have refused, when she and Jim and maybe a handful of other people could have looked at the ring gates and the vastness beyond them, seen the danger, and tiptoed away. All the signs had been there. A civilization had built all this vast and unimaginable power and still been scattered like knuckle bones. What had made them think it was safe for them? That it was worth the risk. She took the tube to Hava's block as if she belonged there. The crowd on the platform was a mix, bright-eyed, tea-drinking third shifters on their way to work, weary second shift just coming home or heading out to dinner. A handful of youths in outlandish fashion burning the first shift midnight oil. Naomi stayed quiet and apart, and she appreciated the beauty of it all, and the innocence. 100 people, more or less, waiting for a tube car on a moon above a planet that circled a sun that hadn't borne them, and jockeying to be the first ones through the door so that they could get a good seat. Maybe the most human thing possible. A young man in a brown, collarless shirt scowled at her for staring, as if maybe she was mocking him. She nodded her apology and looked away. Her life as Chava's guest was pleasant. Waking in a real bed, showering with water that didn't recycle twice while she was under it, eating food that had more than one taste. The long months Naomi had spent in her container felt more and more like a spiritual pilgrimage, a journey she had gone through and emerged from changed. It hadn't seemed like that at the time. Their schedules had drifted, and she was awake long after Hava had gone to bed. Naomi stayed quiet while she worked, but she worked. The underground in Oberon was well developed, but until she decided it was time to throw the governor and his political officers into a hole, her options were limited. Entrench. Develop more holes in their security. Compromise the enemy further. But there was nothing of Laconia's grand strategy to be learned. They were as cut off as she was. And then, only days after her own messages had slipped out through the rings, the bottles began to return. They came in one at a time, a trickle of data that snuck into the system, reports, requests, and messages encrypted with the most recent ciphers. Bara Gaon was on lockdown, but the exploration sites were still autonomous. New Albion had taken the opportunity to sabotage the Laconian transfer station and were now being hunted by the local security forces. Transport Union ships had started making emergency transits to systems like Tabalta and Hope, where local populations were in danger of collapse. It was like slowly beginning to recover her eyesight after being nearly blind. The message from Sol System originated on Callisto. The data passed covertly to a data farm on Ceres and repackaged into a bottle on a Transport Union ship near the Sol Gate. It was routed to her. On the screen, Bobby looked tired and grim. A grayness had come into her features, and the thick muscles of her neck had begun to look wiry. A decryption artifact locked a corner of the image like part of her shoulder was frozen in time while the rest of her was free to move. "Hey there," Bobby said into the camera. And a loneliness Naomi hadn't known she felt swamped her for a moment. She felt the memory of that last hug before she'd left Sol, and it was more alive and real to her than the last time she'd seen Jim. "I have something. An opportunity, I think. Alex wants me to run it past you." Naomi listened as Bobby laid out the situation. The storm trapped in Sol, first by the catastrophe in the slow zone and now by the tempest's presence, the antimatter. She felt herself sliding into the same analytic mindset that had been her whole life in the container. She'd hardly been out, a few weeks on the Bikaji Kama and now here with Chava, and slipping back already felt cold and constraining. Her mind ticked through the implications of Bobby's plan. The exposure of the storm, the scrutiny that would fall on the Jovian moon bases, the symbolic and practical effects of Duarte's losing a second Magnetar-class ship. And as she did, a quiet part of her mourned. The day she'd gone into the container and committed herself to living as a pea in a shell game had been the day she left the Rocinante behind. It felt like relief at the time, like her soul had been rubbed raw and the container was her bandage. Her whole life, she'd survived the unsurvivable by falling back and getting small. And every time, she had come back healed. Scarred sometimes, but healed. All it had taken was a handful of human interactions to show her that the Naomi who had fled into the container wasn't the one who'd come out. Time had passed, and she had found what peace she was going to find. When she'd taken up Saba's role, it had been from necessity, but it had also been because she was ready to. It was only after the fact that she was starting to see what leaders were, the price the position required. The water started hissing, and a door opened and closed from back in Chava's bedroom. She was awake and taking a morning shower. It would be time for Naomi to go to bed soon. It was also safe to respond to Bobby without being an impolite guest. Funny how that still seemed to matter. She set her hand terminal up with the camera pointing to her, then used the security filter to strip out the background. If the signal was intercepted, there wouldn't be artifacts leading back to Chava. It left Naomi looking like she was floating in a featureless void. She started the recording. "Hey, Bobby. Your plan looks solid. I know that's not the argument I was making the last time we spoke, but the situation's changed. Several situations have. I still maintain that working through political means to a peaceful endgame is critical. But if there is a chance to do that without a Magnetar-class ship keeping its boot on Sol System's throat, it'll be easier. If it was just a ship, I think I might still have some reservations. But you're right. Duarte made the Tempest a symbol. We don't often get the chance to kill the enemy's story about itself. Good hunting. I love you." She closed the message, fed it into the local encryption, and queued it to be sent to Bone and his system network. It might take days for it to get onto a bottle and through the gates. She tapped the table with her fingertips, wanting to call it back. There was still time to stop it. Soon there wouldn't be. Hey, Chava said as she stepped in from her bedroom. She was already dressed for her shift. Sharp, professional clothing. Hair neat. What are you up to this fine morning?
Second-guessing myself, Naomi said.
And I think it's my evening. I did make you coffee, though.
You are a kind and thoughtful woman, Chava said as she poured herself a cup.
The drift of the coffee to the cup was like watching the slow fountain. You're going to have traffic analysis problems, though.
You mean the way that vastly more bottles come into and out of Oberon than any other system?
Naomi said.
Yes, that's an issue.
Is it a hint?
I know you weren't looking for a roommate.
You can stay as long as it's the smart move.
But maybe not after?
Chava's smile faded.
What's wrong?
Naomi chuckled.
You mean apart from maybe having sent two of the people I care about most to their deaths?
She wiped her eyes.
Shit.
Chava put down her cup. She took Naomi's hand in hers. The feeling of fingers against her own was almost more than Naomi could stand, and she held on like Chava was a tether.
I spent a lot of my life trying not to be a particular kind of person, Naomi said. Trying not to make certain kinds of decisions. But here I am all the same.
They were silent together for a moment. When Chava spoke, her voice was light, almost conversational.
When I was in my apprenticeship back in the day, the hardest thing I had to do was manual docking. Every time the qualification run came, it didn't matter how much I'd practiced. I'd take the controls, override the system so I had control. The only thing in my head was, don't fuck up, don't fuck up, don't fuck up. And then I'd fuck up. I focused so hard on the thing I was afraid of, I ran straight into its arms every single time.
Are you trying to make me feel better?
No,
Chava said.
We're too old for that.
I'm trying to make you feel like you aren't alone in it.
That's all I've got.
Something in Naomi's chest shifted, a titanic emotion breaking free. She braced herself for sobs, but all that came out was a profound sigh. The dream had been there all along, never quite given up. She would find a way to bring her family back together. They would all survive the meat grinder of history. Everything would somehow be well. There had been a moment. It hadn't been that long ago. All she'd had to do was announce herself, accept Duarte's invitation, and leave all the struggle behind. She couldn't remember quite how she'd decided on this path, but she saw that she had. There was no one to blame but herself. She conjured up the dream of waking up beside Jim, drinking coffee with him, hearing Alex and Amos joking with the subtle hum of the Rocinante behind them. She let it go. She squeezed Chava's hand and let that go too. Chapter 29. Elvie. Elvie sat in the back of the car. The driver was a young man with close-cut, tightly curled hair. Mostly what she saw of him was the back of his neck. As the state building fell away behind them, the city itself spread out. She could still remember the first time she'd seen it, brought in by soldiers with the scrupulous politeness of a concierge at a luxury hotel, only with sidearms. The streets were wider than anywhere she'd ever been, with greenways along the sides. Buildings rose up, tall and beautiful, with solar collection windows and rooftop gardens, like Frank Lloyd Wright had been reborn and made skyscrapers. The scale of the place was massive and boastful. She remembered being overwhelmed by it the first time. Now, it seemed weirdly brittle, Millions of people lived in the capital city, and almost none of them had been there longer than a decade. The traffic was stopped for her motorcade, and she saw the normal people, civilians and citizens and military with status lower than hers, craning their necks as she passed, trying to figure out who she was and whether they should be excited to see her. There were no monuments, no billboards, no old neighborhoods. She sort of hated it. "Would you like some water, ma'am?" the driver asked. "No," Elvie said. "Thank you." He nodded without looking back at her. She leaned back into the plush seat and tried to straighten her leg. It didn't help the ache. The labs were massive. Technically, it was part of the University of Laconia, but it was run like a military camp. The gate guards waved them through without checking, and the car took a looping path through campus, heading toward the pens. She fidgeted with her cane. As they made the last turn, a man came into view, clearly waiting for her. The relief that flooded her when she saw that it wasn't Paolo Cortázar was telling. "Dr. Uchida," she said as she levered herself up out of the car. "Dr. Okoye, it's good to have you back. I heard about your field work. I have to say, you aren't selling me on it over nice, safe labs." "Well, the data was interesting," she said as they started down the path to the pen. It was a dark, windowless cube, hardened against attack even in the heart of the Empire, where attack seemed impossible. They said God didn't play dice, but if he did, they'd look like the pen. Huge, square, and inscrutable. "I hear they're sending you into the Holy of Holies," Uchida said. "Paolo's very close with this senescence project." "It wasn't my choice." "The High Council does what the High Council does," Uchida said as they reached the guards. Elvie handed over her ID badge and submitted to the verification scan. It was just a touch on her wrist, but it felt more invasive than that. "With the rich and powerful, always a little patience," she said. The guards stood away and let them through. There was a little pop when the door opened and the air pushed in with them. Inside, the next set of security protocols blasted them with air and scanned every millimeter of their bodies before the inner door opened. Inside, the pen was almost more reassuring. It looked like the kind of lab she'd been in for decades, on and off, at half a dozen universities and research institutions. Safety procedures were posted on the wall in bright fonts in six languages. The air smelled of phenol soap and air scrubbers. "Come on," Uchida said with a smile. "I'll walk you over." "Don't get comfortable," Elvie told herself. "This isn't your home court. You aren't safe here." "I just had the most interesting conversation," Fayez had said back on the day she'd first been assigned her task. "I could say the same, but mine's classified. So why don't you go first?" "Well, he was being awfully cagey. But I think our old friend Holden just told me Cortázar's plotting murder." Elvie had laughed because it was a statement too horrifying to match the pleasant setting, and sometimes being overwhelmed was kind of funny. "I'm not sure I can deal with that right now," she said. And then,
"Did he really?"
Fayez shrugged. "No, he didn't. He very carefully and specifically didn't. We had a perfectly lovely conversation about the importance of teaching children about negative space as a tool of political analysis. Then we talked about everyone at the head of the science effort, except Cortázar, while he made significant eye contact. And then made a weird segue into the history of political power struggles on old Earth with a focus on Richard III. That's obscure." "Not that obscure. Shakespeare wrote a play about him."
"What was it called?"
"Richard III," Fayez said. "Are you feeling all right?" She leaned her head against his shoulder. He was warmer than usual, but it wasn't strange to run a low-grade fever when a limb was regrowing. I wasn't a theater major, and I've had a long day. What was the point of it? Richard was an asshole and killed a bunch of people, but specifically a couple of kids. Heirs to the throne or something. You weren't a theater major either. I was not. Far above them, a thin sheet of clouds moved across the stars, blotting some and revealing others. She wanted to close her eyes and fall asleep right there, and wake up in their shitty apartment back on Ceres before she'd ever heard of Laconia or Duarte at all. All the things she'd learned, all the money and status and discovery, could vanish like a dream, and she'd still have been happy, as long as all the rest of it went too. So negative space, and then everyone but Cortázar, and a king who killed some kids. Well, technically a prince who clawed his way to power by killing some kids, I think. Spiffy, she said. Wasn't Cortázar one of the ones that worked for Protogen back before Eros? Back during Eros, Elvie said. I'm just saying it wouldn't be his first time. He created the catalyst, Elvie said. For me. Doesn't mean I'm a murderer. Yeah, Fayez said, but he knew she was thinking, except that it kind of does. That was what decades of marriage were for. Intimacy and pattern matching as a kind of telepathy. He sighed, shifted, and put an arm around her. I may have been reading more into it than was there. It just seemed strange and kind of pointed. He meant something by it, Elvie said. Maybe not what you got, exactly, but something. You're thinking about tracking him down and asking him? I am. If he was being oblique because Duarte's got an eye on him, he won't be straight with you any more than he was with me. Unless I let him know that Duarte isn't watching anything right now, Elvie thought. The idea left a cold mark that could have been fear or excitement, or something of both. She wondered what Trejo would think, and if Holden was even on the new secret emperor's radar. Maybe I can come up with something, Elvie said. And maybe she could have, if they hadn't discovered Amos Burton and his pocket nuke that night, and Holden hadn't been thrown in a cell before morning. Cortázar smiled when he saw her, like it was something he'd told himself to remember to do. Elvie felt like her answering nod was equally fake, but she didn't know if he'd notice or care. "Anything else I can help with, Paolo?" Ochida asked. "Thank you, no," Cortázar said. "We'll be fine." Ochida stepped away. Everything about it was perfectly normal and polite. It all felt like a threat. Cortázar turned and started walking toward a set of metal doors. She had to trot to catch up with him. "I'm sorry we had to push this until after lunch," he said. "I've been at the security office all morning going over the things they took from the spy." "Amos Burton," Elvie said. "Kelly briefed me. It's a little weird. I knew him. We were both on Illis at the same time. He saved my husband's life." "Well, he had a pocket nuke with him in that cave, so..." Cortázar wagged his hand in a so-so gesture. "I was with the analysis team. Trejo's looking at the communication deck pretty carefully. It looks like the bastard's been out there for quite a long time." "Do we know what he wanted?" "Not yet. But we may still get to ask him." "I thought he was dead." "Oh my, yes, very much so." "Then how?" He presented his lanyard to a locking mechanism, and the doors cycled open. She followed him into a darker corridor. The walls were thicker, reinforced. It was a little sobering to think that the raw protomolecule of the pen wasn't the most dangerous thing in the lab. "Illich fucked that whole thing up badly," Cortázar said. "Not his fault. He didn't know not to leave the body behind. The doors closed behind them with a deep sound, like a prison. The corridor acted as an airlock. After they shot the poor fucker in the head, Illich pulled everyone back to protect the little princess, Cortázar said. She heard the sneer in his voice and thought of Richard III. He should have left someone guarding the body, or burned it before he left. Not his fault, really. He knows the rules about the repair drones, but he doesn't know the reason behind them. A second set of doors opened, light spilling into the hallway. I don't understand, Elvi said.
You will,
Cortázar said lightly as he walked into the private lab. He'd been teasing her. This lab was smaller than the pen. She recognized some of the equipment from her own exobiology labs, array sequencers, proteome sample analyzer, NIR and low-resonance scanners. Other things were as strange as any of the alien artifacts she'd come across. Cortázar ignored them all, stepping across to a transparent polymer cage the size she'd seen used for simian and large animal studies.
Trejo thinks having a new set of eyes on all this will help, but the truth is you're going to be playing catch-up for months just to get to the point you can ask intelligent questions, he said. But, to get you started, these were the original cases, the seed grit in our oyster.
Two children were in the cage, a boy maybe 7 or 8 years old, and a girl on the edge of adolescence. Their eyes were perfectly black, like the pupils had eaten iris and sclera alike. The girl stood up and walked toward the front face of the cage. Her skin was grayish. She moved almost normally, but when she stopped, there was a terrible stillness about her. What? Elvi said, and then didn't know how to finish the question. She'd heard the phrase, "It made my flesh crawl," but she thought it was a figure of speech, until then.
They were Alexander and Kara Bisset, when they were alive, Cortázar said. Children of the initial scientific expedition that was on Laconia before the High Consul relocated his loyalists here. The boy died in an accident. The girl was poisoned, trying to eat local flora in the wilderness not long after. This is what happens when you have a dead body around the repair drones. Or, well, sometimes. They don't always take it upon themselves to fix things, but when they do... He nodded toward the dead children. This is what happens.
I don't know you, the girl said.
My name's Elvi.
I'm Kara. Are you going to hurt us too?
Oh, Elvi thought. Oh, fuck this. I don't care what it takes. As soon as I get out of here, I will find a way to never, ever come back.
The original bodies died 20 years ago, more or less, Cortázar said. These artifacts that were built from them have been static since their recovery.
So they'll always be young?
Well, they'll always look like immature human beings, Cortázar said. That's not exactly the same thing. They have, for the most part, similar structures and chemistry to the original bodies, only very stable. Telomere don't shorten. Mitosis can run indefinitely. There's no build-up of senescent cells or plaques. The immune response has a couple additional pathways and structures that are interesting. Really very nice work.
That's amazing, Elvi said, and the words felt like dropping a stone down a well, deep and kind of hollow.
The High Consul's interest in personal immortality came from them. He thought that if we could learn the differences in structure and function from these samples and reverse-engineer them into a living body instead of a corpse, sort of the way carbon-silicate lace plating was based on long-lived architectural structures, well, that would be interesting. I tried a few animal models first and made enough progress that I felt comfortable with a human trial. She leaned on her cane and fought back the dizziness.
Duarte agreed to that. Cortázar turned to look at her. He seemed confused.
Of course he did. It was the answer to his biggest problem. How do you hold a galaxy-spanning empire together over generations? Have someone running it who doesn't die. Well, here they are. Things that have all the traits you need not to age and die.
Wasn't he worried something might, I don't know, go wrong?
He understood there was some risk, but he thought it was justified by the possible return. We went very carefully, and the High Consul had a great deal of faith in my abilities.
All right, Elvi said. Okay.
It was fine until you triggered that...
He gestured at her injured leg.
It was working. It may still work with some adjustments and a new subject.
I didn't trigger anything. That was Segale following orders, she said. But what she thought was a new subject like Teresa. It didn't sit right.
Cortázar turned his attention back to the children in the cage.
No. He wants it for himself.
I have complete records, of course, Cortázar said. I have them set up for you on the system here. Take as long as you want looking over them.
In here?
The project doesn't exist outside of this room. The High Consul was very clear on that. And I can't imagine Admiral Trejo would want to reduce security.
The private lab was smaller, all told, than her office back at the State Building. The younger one, the boy, came to stand beside what had been his sister. Elvi was going to be under their eyes the whole time she was here. She wondered whether Cortázar had set it up like that to make her uncomfortable, and whether the information he showed her would be anywhere close to complete.
Wait, she said. Amos Burton's body was missing.
They're out looking for it now, Cortázar said. It will be very useful having an adult subject to compare with. I mean, it would mean more if I had complete scans and medical records of him from before the corpse was modified. That's what we really need to move forward. But I'll enjoy this all the same. There's a restroom just outside the hall, and if you need food, you should probably have it outside. We've only ever had one unintentional protomolecule contamination, but...
Understood, she said, and sat at the low monitor. The chair squeaked.
I'll come check in on you later, Cortázar said. He forgot to smile this time.
The doors closed behind him, and Elvi turned to the reports and the data. Her head felt like it was full of bees. There was too much, and it left her unsettled and jumpy. She expected Cortázar's work to bounce off her brain and puddle on the floor. Actually engaging with it was too much to ask. But once she'd started looking through it, her focus started coming back, and a familiar calm came over her. Other people might take reassurance in a lover's hand or a cup of herbal tea, really a tisane, since it didn't have tea leaves, but tea was the term people used anyway, which Elvi had always thought interesting. Elvi only had room in her mind for learning or panicking. She couldn't do both, and she didn't like panic. The thing that struck her first was how small the differences really were. Cortázar wasn't a biologist. His background was nanoinformatics, which had a huge overlap when it came to things like genetics, epigenetics, and heritable cytoplasmic proteins, but missed basics like anatomy. The way the kids' hearts had changed to adjust for a different viscosity in their plasma, the way that their blood had changed to a more efficient, non-cell-bound hemoglobin analog, all the other tweaks and modifications weren't really changes in kind. They were just improvements. Evolution was a paste and baling wire process that came up with half-assed solutions like pushing teeth through babies' gums and menstruation. Survival of the fittest was a technical term that covered a lot more close enough is close enough than actual design. When she looked up and saw the children looking back at her, it was 5 hours later. Her leg ached like hell, and the fear was gone.